Hi, my name's Tim Oldman. I'm the founder and CEO of the Leisman Index, the world's largest benchmarking and insight database on employee workplace experience. Since launching back in 2010, I've been fortunate enough to probe and debate the subject with some of the sector's best thought leaders. And these podcasts aim to package up some of those debates for you. And one of those grand masters is here with me in New York City this afternoon. Gordon, why don't you introduce yourself?
Gordon Wright, and I lead HOK's Global Workplace Practice.
We're guilty of bumping into each other at various places around the world, conferences and discussions and our events and your events, and normally managing to grab 15 or 20 minutes on an aside over a coffee or a beer and having...
Preferably a beer.
Yeah, and normally setting the world to rights in one form or other, the world place work to rights. The last conversation we had in Philadelphia sort of suggested that we both recognized, and a number of our friends in the industry also having these conversations, that the architectural profession is at a bit of a junction, that it doesn't know whether to reinvent itself, but it recognizes that it's got pressures to be more strategic in its thinking, and that there are real estate advisors taking on those types of services and those types of briefs. There are the traditional strategy consultancies that are, I don't think they're making any massive plans and inroads into the workplace world, but are being drawn into that conversation, probably by their corporate clients. So let's talk a little bit for a moment about where you are as a practice and your own role in leading that, in where you think the challenge is for architecture and interior design and workplace strategy.
Well, I'll start by saying I think that the architectural industry, the practice of architecture, the practice of design, has been impacted by a couple things, and some of our own making and some outside forces. The industry is rooted in tradition and rooted in practice. And those types of industries, if you compare them to other industries, are harder to change. It's never been about innovation. Now, yes, on the technology side, smart buildings, building technology, file and drawing technology, absolutely we embrace that, and as do all the big global firms. You have to be competitive. But in terms of how we practice and how we go to the market and how we advise our clients, it's really difficult to change. It's because of the studio mentality. You start as a... back in the day as a draftsman, and then you become a senior draftsman, and then somebody, you sit for your tests and you have AIA after your name. Or if you're an interior designer, you become an interior designer, you're no longer an intern. And that is deeply ingrained, and it's hard to step away and say, how do we innovate faster? What does innovation mean, number one, in our industry, and two, how do we do it more quickly? So we are still locked in as outside forces are forcing us to change. Some of those outside forces that I've certainly seen, particularly in the world of workplace when we're dealing with primarily large global or large regional institutions, they're driven by a procurement process. And that procurement process requires nimbleness. It requires you to boil things down to their very essence very quickly. And it requires you to speak the language of spreadsheets and dollars and cents. And that's typically not where we come from the design side of the world. We as an industry, we think about developing, creating space, buildings that are going to be inhabited by human beings. We very rarely think about it from a standpoint of how do we do that differently. The tools, yes, have changed, but the ways of thinking and applying those tools are still the same.
I'm going to challenge that point just for the sake of dialogue and discussion and debate a little bit. But do you think designers really think about the occupiers of the space? You know, I think it's still rare that we see an employee-centric approach to workplace design.
Well, I agree with you, and I'll say some are beginning to. I would say that age is a factor. The older, the longer you spend in the industry, the more difficult it is to think about who's going to occupy and use that space. What we're seeing in our practice is the younger designers are much more adept at taking into consideration, and not even consideration, but really designing. We sometimes call it designing from the outside in. Who's going to occupy? Who's going to be inside that building? Both the space planners, the architects, the interior designers having a holistic view versus architects going to design a building with curtain walls and a skin and then bring the interior folks in and you can do what you will because we're done. And I think as a practice, in the practice that I'm in, we have embraced that. But as individual designers, individual architects, I find that the younger people have had that, whether it's from their training or from the world, that as the world changed in terms of the technologies they're used to, how they've grown up, they very much are more conditioned or more apt to think about how this space is going to impact its occupier versus more senior and people that have been in the industry longer look at it very much about the design and the occupant and the user will figure it out.
So we're talking about a generation for whom the sort of the hackability of space or the hackability of products is part of the world they live in. Do you think now we're at a point where the traditional corporate model for delivering a corporate workplace of the engagement of professional teams, the delivery to a set target handover date, and then almost waving goodbye to the professional team? You sort of bring the team together, you deliver a product, or you're expected to deliver a product, comes back to your point about the commoditization of services, but you deliver a product and then you're disbanded as a team and the client waves goodbye to you. Are we talking about a new need for you to be retained as the advisor after that point of practical completion?
I'll answer it in two ways, Tim. I think first off is the simple answer is yes, but it's a slow adaptation because there's a cost to it, one. Secondly, we're seeing the firms who actually care about how the occupants live in that space and how they feel about that space and really look at is their workplace as a place they want to be, not just enabling work, but a place that I actually want to go to. Those are the ones that are understanding there's something has to happen once that space has been delivered. And whether that's checking that space periodically, coming back with our engagement of the occupant around change engagement, change management, that's an ongoing thing. It doesn't stop 1 month after we've entered. Many clients are aware of that. Many have yet to adapt that behavior.
So, but every one of those clients would have a retained legal representation. They'll have retained accountancy or audit practices. How is it that architecture has failed miserably to establish itself as another one of those retained advisors, that sort of trusted advisory capacity that those other professions have, that architecture has somehow just never managed to attain the mantle of?
I have a couple of theories, and maybe we can have this conversation again and we can find if one or any of my theories are correct. Number one is that it's always come from an aesthetic. Usability has not been about the occupant. Usability is about how the building and the space functions as a space, as a thing. It's never been about how it functions for you and for me sitting inside of that space and using it. And I think that's been in our industry for thousands of years, literally. It's what you want it to look like and how you want it to function. It's not how it's going to work for the occupier.
Okay, so in a global practice of your stature, HOK stature, where you have multiple other disciplines around sports stadia, shopping centers, hospitals, where in all of those areas, evidence-based design is something that the design professionals would assume will be brought to the table. How is it, again, that in workplace design, there is such a lack of evidence-based design discipline?
I think it's fair to my colleagues who are interior designers to say this, because many of them would probably say it if they were sitting here with us in this conversation, is that what has been driving this conversation has been the aesthetic, the color, the furnishings, the textiles. We're just now, and it seems strange, but we're just now starting to talk about the person who's going to sit on that chair, the person who's going to use that ergonomic keyboard, the person who's going to use that light, the person who's going to walk down that hallway and what their experience is going to be. That's actually relatively new considering how long that design and architecture have been a practice for thousands of years. That's a relatively new phenomenon. And I think that's part of where there is a rate of adaption, just like we've seen in many industries of technologies. We are still, when it comes to the workplace, it's the last holdout, if you will, of really looking at the science that says, how is this space and that way we design it going to affect the occupant and how they can perform in this space? If you look at, for example, of our healthcare practice, everything in healthcare is outcome-based. Everything. It starts when you pull into the parking garage with your loved one in the car or you step off the train to walk to that hospital. That's where it starts. It doesn't, that way of thinking and that way of looking at the space is new to workplace. And I would argue in the last several years new.
That if a client is listening to this would be potentially a sort of shocking revelation, wouldn't it? That somehow the widest aspects of the design profession have a great and thorough understanding of environmental psychology, of the interaction with people in space, usability, human factor design, but that somehow for this little area where thousands upon thousands of people are accommodated on a daily basis in corporate workplace environments who are employed to produce outputs that are probably outcome measured or output measured in some form or another, that are appraised annually based on their personal performance, that there is little, if any, appraisal of the ability of the space to support their personal productivity or their personal well-being.
I would use the word shocking, because if you think and step back of what we said earlier when we're talking about buildings, much of building architecture, much of building design is a science now. It's a coursework you can go take at a university and learn about the science of how buildings are constructed, how they interact with their environment, with humans inside of them. But when we come to the workplace, the inside of those buildings, it's the last place to take that scientific approach. And we still forge on with, I like that color, I like that fixture, I like that chair. And I think that the next, going back to this sort of ingrained behavior, the next generation, which we already have with us now, who are already sitting in those chairs designing for our clients, they think that way. And again, I don't want to predispose that it's the university systems they're coming out of. I think they're, in some ways, they're part of the sort of culture of design. But it's these younger people are beginning to look at the spaces of how they're going to be used, any space, not just from a building science perspective, but other sciences are beginning to influence their thinking. And that's, I think, it is a departure from what we've seen in the past. Building science has been around perhaps 2 decades now, and I may be wrong on that number, but it's approximately right. What we're seeing, as I said earlier, with the sciences being applied to the occupancy of these buildings is relatively new within the last several years.
It also worries me, though, that we're moving into an era where that younger generation that we talk about as design professionals also have access to tools that you and I would have never dreamt of, like being able to sketch a product that afternoon, model it three-dimensionally in CAD, and by the end of the day before they go home, having sent it to a 3D printer and having it there in front of them. Do you think also there's a risk that younger designers will feel empowered to reinvent things that just frankly don't need reinventing?
I'm going to say I haven't thought about that directly, but I've seen signs of it. And your question is, every one of our offices around the world, we have 3D printers. And some of our big offices, we have them lined up against the wall. And those are primarily doing model studies. That's primarily what they're used for now. The printers can do them much quicker than a model shop can do them.
Yep.
But we're beginning to see this now where we have a product design group within HOK. And we're designing chairs, and we're designing workstations, and we're designing gathering areas for space, where young designers are beginning to look at that as sort of the way to reinvent the chair. And in some ways, I would say that that's the furniture worlds. They've reinvented the chair 1,000 times, so sometimes I can't even recognize it as a chair. I think this is bigger than that. And I hope that these young, smart people will take these technologies and really try to apply it to not another chair, not another workstation, but looking at it more holistically and looking at the data that's available to them that wasn't 10 years ago, that certainly wasn't 20 years ago, and begin to look at that and say, we should be looking at the outcomes of the people, not the fact that they like chair A better than chair B, or the fabric on chair B better than chair A.
We engage professionally around the idea of a standardized pre- and a post-occupancy evaluation technique of that experience. And we are one of those parties flooding the market with data that those young designers could be embracing and using. If design is taught as an intuitive art form, how can we encourage the design community to, I don't know, sort of, you know, pick up the pitchforks and the spades and take on the barricades with that data? Or should we be actually instead expecting clients to be better informed about their own needs? So it's a UK statute phrase, I think, about, you know, let the buyer beware. Let's actually challenge the buyers of our services to come to market and be better informed when they arrive there, rather than just, as you talked about earlier, actually the sort of, you know, just the beauty parade of professional service firms.
I, for one, would love it if our buyers were there. And I don't think the buyers are there, the end user. And I don't think us as the service provider, the consultant, the designer is there yet. So I'd like us to get there together. That'd be a perfect marriage. And I don't know which of us is going to get there, but I feel as a practitioner, it's our responsibility to try to lead the clients there. I would love it if they get there when I do, even if they beat us, I'd like that too. I think one of our challenges is that there's a set of metrics which aren't necessarily conducive to having this conversation, and that often those metrics are what's driving the purchasing decision versus really the metrics about what happens in that space, how that space performs for that organization, and how those people, 80% of the cost of that organization, perform within that space. That's what I think is in front of us right now, and we got to get over that. And I think if we can get over that, then we can help lead our clients, and I think it's a challenge for both the design industry and for the client. It's the same challenge. We approach it from different sides. We're providing the design. They're providing the template to fill out to say, how much does this design cost? Both of us are going to have to get there.
Mm-hmm. But maybe then the pace of change that the clients are having to go through will encourage them to do that, to be more, I don't know, have more foresight about the purpose of workplace. So if you're a credit union in the US at the moment, competing for digital talent in a way that 5 years ago would have been inconceivable, maybe, you know, that external pressure from our clients' customer base will create a different dynamic in what they come out to the market to expect from the design practitioners.
Well, we've had a term 10, 15 years now, talent management, and a little bit of background in that in my past life, but I still think that's a misused. The term would suggest a process, would suggest that you provide that talent what they need to do their jobs. And I still think that talent management organization, typically human resources within the organizations we're talking about, is challenged by the fact that they are kept out of these conversations, whether by their own doing or by procurement departments or the business unit within the organization. And what we're finding is that often the metrics don't take into account personal behavior or human behavior in these spaces. So those are sort of a tack on later, oh, we've done our company survey, here's what we found out. You're occupying the space that you've spent millions of dollars to build out, and now we're going to come back and give you some data about how that space is performing. And I think that's one of the big disconnects, is that often this conversation, and I've been there, so this is not to rain down on the parade of my real estate colleagues, but we often use metrics which are about time and cost. Those are our two big metrics. And our human resources friends, I almost said in the basement, but hopefully they're no longer in the basement, have similar but different metrics. That I think if those metrics became a part of how we make decisions about the space, we'd all be a lot better off.
As the strategy lead within HOK, that you must feel frustrated often when you're in front of a client and they're throwing another one of the sort of fashion must-haves at you. We've got an event tomorrow here in New York on activity-based working, but it's just one of many, right, in the marketplace at the moment that people are pouring over to try and understand whether it's a benefit or not. So fashion fad or strategy must-have?
I think it could be a bit of both. And you had asked a question earlier about, you know, sort of the pace of change. And a lot of what we see is a snippet of information, and somebody reads something and suddenly that's what they have to have. And, you know, we can see this in consumer goods. We can see the same thing as a great company, Apple. They develop an iWatch and suddenly they're ubiquitous. You go into meetings and everybody's got their iWatch on. Did you really need that? What happened to the function of my good old Seiko analog? It was working pretty good. A little bit of that has crept into the sort of notion of my workplace style or the way my people work. And I think we want to label everything. And labels can do good things. Labels can help us identify and compare groups or compare activities. But I also think they can be negative in that there's a what's next factor when you start to label things. Great. So what proceeds? I was in a meeting the other day and a CFO asked us, what comes after activity-based working? Well, if I knew the answer to that, I probably wouldn't be sitting in this meeting. And that's what I'm a little bit concerned with, is let's do something really well and really nail it. And one of the big things we tell our clients over and over is you have to provide choice. And Tim, I've heard you talk about this. You have to provide choice. That's the number one thing. It's not trying to say Tim's this type of worker, Gordon's this type of worker, and Mary's this type of worker. That's not what it's about. And when we get into that behavior, that's where I think we miss it. And when we have to find a new label because we've tried to categorize everybody and then we find a population of worker who no longer fits into that category. So I think there's a bit of that driving as what's next. We also had a question from the same individual who said, I want to future-proof my workplace for 10 years. How do I do that? Again, that's one of those, if I could tell you how to future-proof your workplace for 10 years, probably wouldn't be sitting in the chair I'm sitting in right now. I'd be out doing something else. Having said that, yes, there's ways to look forward based on what we've learned from the past. But I do think there's a factor of fad. It's, okay, we did that, now what's next? I also would, in many colleagues in the industry who are much deeper in this area than I am, but I also think it's about perfecting is a strong word, but getting right what you have, going back and constantly evaluating and making those little tweaks rather than jumping into a new definition and saying, I need to change my workplace and starting that cycle all over. Now, as a design firm, we love it when companies come to us and say, great, we're going to change 80 million square feet across the world. Terrific. But that's a lot harder done than said. It's real easy to say, I'm going to go change the way we work. And frankly, much of this is about is giving the employees, as we said, choice and supporting them in what their jobs are. And I have begun to say this more and more is creating a workplace. The objective should be a place where people want to go. And then secondly, it supports their work. And if you think if you look at it that way, we can start to step back from the next label of work style. Yes, we can define work styles, but there's always going to be the next thing coming. So how do we look at how our people work, how we support them in the way they work, call it whatever we will, and continually manage that, perfect that, and again, perfection's a big word, but continually work on that so we really get it right before we have to go out and embrace the new next big thing.
So this goes back to the point, though, about the idea that, you know, once you configure a team, you deliver a project, you hand over, and then you disappear off to your next creative brief. Another conversation that we've had with another strategy consultant talked about the idea of clients actually retaining, I don't know, 25, 30% of the capital allocated budget for post-occupancy alteration. So actually, is the way to future-proof it to either allocate substantial future budgets to the management and the adaption and the flexibility of workplace, or hold back some of that initial spend. Now, if you're a design team, a client saying, hey, look, I've got $3 million to spend on this space, but I'm only going to give you $2 million today. If you get it, you know, if we get on well, there's another $1 million do you have over the next 5 years? That would be a brave move for a client, but it sounds like one that you'd embrace.
Absolutely, because I think it puts the stakes and the in goals, we're joined at the hip. We're connected on achieving that. I think the pattern we're in now, and this kind of goes back to the design industry and the way design services are procured, is that there's almost an adversarial relationship. And very rarely can we sit down and say, let's take the numbers off the table. Yes, we'll come back. We know this has to be achievable. We know it has to fall within a budget, et cetera. But what are we both trying to achieve here? So what's your end game? And back to the question we had about future-proofing, maybe there is a way to start to look at this differently to say, we can design a space for this cost that 5 years from now will still have high performance versus 5 years from now, nobody wants to work in it. And some of those spaces we see that 5 years and maybe even before 5 years look really good. That's the tricky part is, again, going back to what we talked about earlier, the set it can get in the way of how the space actually functions. So the space can be maintained well. It can have the right furnishings, the right furniture, but it can be an awful space to work. And there's a lot of things that go into that, obviously, beyond just the aesthetics. But that's part of it is to measure that. And we've begun to advocate to our clients that they're using some device to measure it annually. Compare against a benchmark and say, how are we doing? And if they're not doing that, then I think the client and the advisor can be susceptible to what the next trend is and try to make these big leaps to get ahead of competition, to get the right talent in, where I think if there's a strategy and that strategy is implemented and then carefully managed and reviewed and updated, that's a lot, probably in most cases, a lot safer way to get to a future-proof in quotes workplace than it is to try to be leapfrogging using technology and the latest greatest work style that are out there.
So this comes back to the point about you can't photograph a strategy.
Nope.
But you can photograph a damn good looking space and you can plaster that all over the trade journals and the magazines and you can walk into a client presentation with a PowerPoint deck that displays that beauty. But you know, walking into a client presentation with a table of data that says, hey, look, we reduced absenteeism rates by 25% and we increased talent management or talent attraction to this practice by 5%. That's not the realm of most interior design practices, architectural firms, is it just yet?
No.
But could that change?
I have faith that the change will come, but I don't think it's going to happen overnight,
right,
Tim. I think that it's a mindset shift, to be careful in saying that word, that has to take place both in the industry, our industry that is the design industry, and on the client side. I think it's actually easier, and if any of my brethren on the architecture side cringe as I say this, I hope they'll forgive me. I think it's easier to do a building because it is more driven around metrics that are firmly established scientifically. Without those metrics firmly established that both sides agree to in the workplace, I think it's difficult. And that is the challenge that I think both sides, as I said earlier, got to come to the table with. If we keep driving on one side of, we'll solve it, it looks nice, you like how it looks, and we're going to use these things to make it look nice and comfortable, and the other side of that equation is a procurement person with a spreadsheet, I don't know if we're ever going to get to spaces that have longer lives, and at the end of that lifespan, of the space lifespan, are still functioning very, very well, and that can be measured, the satisfaction of the employees that are occupying it.
Yeah.
I mean, you've shared things that I've seen in some of your talks where you've shown spaces that didn't necessarily look like all-star spaces, but they performed like all-stars. And I could show you from our portfolio of spaces that have been designed where they look terrific, but the performance of the space in terms of how it's utilized by its occupants is actually quite low. Mm. So I think one of the things you had asked a question about, you know, are we headed down the path of just reinventing with young, new design talent coming in? And I do think there's hope because I think they're more open and aware of and sort of see as a matter of course more inputs, more data sets than those my age grew up with in our training and in our practices. And I think the design training teaches you to stand behind your design,
yeah,
right? You never want to walk away and say, nope, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
You have to stand behind it.
Really interesting. Thanks very much indeed. Well, look, I hope that's got you thinking. And if you have a suggestion for a subject you'd like me to probe or someone you think I should be talking to, please feel free to let me know. You can, of course, connect with me or anyone of the Leisman team via any of the usual channels. And to stay up to date with our thinking, just head to leismanindex.com. Thanks for listening.